This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of arts and culture from NPR. I'm Felix Contreras of NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Bob Mondello, film critic for All Things Considered.
You can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week on Culturetopia,
Gene Wilder turns from the screen to the page with a new collection of short stories about love.
And NPR's Adam Davidson tries to find out why there are so many elaborately painted buses in Haiti.
And comedian Ben Stiller gets serious for his new film, Greenberg. But first,
the singer Erykah Badu's newly released music video is causing quite a sensation, and not just because of the music. In the 5-minute video for the song Window Seat, Badu slowly takes off all of her clothes, while walking through the streets of Dallas. And not just any street. Badu parades through Dealey Plaza and feigns being shot near the spot where President Kennedy was assassinated. Michelle Norris spoke with Robert Wolanski, a senior writer with the Dallas Observer and a fan of Erykah Badu, about the video and the so-called controversy.
You know, it's been interesting here, especially given that she filmed this video at Dealey Plaza, obviously the site of Kennedy assassination in November of 1963. That is very much the reason why she chose that particular site. As she has said in interviews since the video was released, that she went down there because she figured that, she would be victim of her own character assassination following this video's release, and that certainly seems to be the case.
At base, what was she trying to say?
It's a good question, in as much as that we sit here and try to examine an artist's intentions when, in fact, all we can really examine at the end of the day is our reaction to them. What was she trying to say? I think she was trying to say something about revealing yourself, about bearing your soul, about the response and reactions that her music provides and provokes in all of us. But ultimately, whenever an artist does something this provocative, it simply reflects back upon us. The thing I like most about it is the fact that, if nothing else, for a few days, Dealey Plaza is no longer known as the place where John Kennedy was killed, but it's simply known as the place where Erykah Badu got naked.
And made art.
You can hear the full interview at nprmusic.org.
We know him as an actor, as the star of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, or as accountant Leo Bloom in The Producers, the original one way back when. But Gene Wilder is also a writer. He's the author or co-author of the screenplays Haunted Honeymoon, The Woman in Red, and with Mel Brooks, Young Frankenstein. He's also published a memoir and novels, and now a collection of short stories called What Is This Thing Called Love? The stories are all about different kinds of love. Wilder spoke to Talk of the Nation's Neil Conan about the origins of his book.
Writing is hard work. I think people think these words flow easily.
Well, acting is hard work also. I mean, lots of things are hard work, but I think writing, for me, after I started acting at 13 years old, I like writing now much more than I do acting, partly because the scripts that are offered are junk. I don't say all of them, but the ones that are offered to me, I say I don't want to do that. Explosives and special effects and $200 million budgets and things like that. And so I'd rather, unless something else comes along that's wonderful, I'd rather write at home with my wife, Karen, and go into my study after breakfast and write for maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours, come out, get a cup of tea, go back in, write a little more, come out, have a little lunch, give my wife a kiss, go back in. And maybe at 4 o'clock, 4:30, I stop writing. I say, that's enough for today. It's very comforting.
That does sound like a nice day.
Well, it is a nice day. You should see my wife. You'd think it's even nicer.
You tell the story of people who fall in love for the first time. Indeed, it's a story in love for the first time, a story of David and Lily, who are students in Paris.
Right. I start out with my cousin Buddy, who was a unique character in the first story, but then I wanted to progress from people who are just learning about love and who have never had sex before. They've talked about it. They've thought about it, but they've never had it. And I wanted to work up how it might actually happen with people. In this case, I wanted it to take place by these two people who were studying music in Paris, and they met each other, and how they got together, and how it came about that they first found out about sex. Mm.
In a lot of the stories, it turns out to be, those are very young people, but you set the story some time ago. They're stories about people your age.
Well, sure. Yes, I'm in all of them, in a sense, but I'm in them when I was 30, when I was 40, and when I was 50. But I there's something about me I know in all of the stories, but I don't like to talk about it as being me. I don't want the story to be Gene Wilder. I want it to be characters that I've come up with, invented.
Do you think?
But they're always based on people that I've met.
Do you think they're... You talk about these characters because they're more useful to the story, or because you think in some way they're more interesting than you?
Ooh, now you're getting deep.
I'm sorry.
I would say both, because they're going to help the stories. But in some regard, I think that if I just talked about me, except for one or two situations, I think the characters would be more interesting than me. You know, people say, you're the funniest guy. I saw you with Richard Pryor, and I saw with Mel Brooks and Zero Mostel, and you must be some funny guy. Well, I'm not. I mean, occasionally I am. I can make my wife laugh once in a while, but I'm not that way. I'm pretty quiet and often very shy, but... when I write a story, I want to break out and write something daring, and that's why I wrote these stories.
Later in that same Talk of the Nation program, Neil Conan spoke with Ben Stiller. Stiller, of course, is the son of comedians and best known for his roles in comedies like Something About Mary and Meet the Parents and Tropic Thunder. But with his new film Greenberg, directed by Noah Baumbach, he's taken on a more serious role. He plays a 40-something musician-turned-carpenter just released from a psychiatric hospital. He's trying to find meaning in his life by, it turns out, doing nothing, a decision that intrigues a young woman named Florence, played by Greta Gerwig.
I'm impressed by you.
In what way?
I don't know. I mean, you seem really fine doing nothing. It's like you don't feel all the pressure to be successful. I mean, by other people's standards.
You know, I almost had a record deal when I got out of college. I haven't done nothing.
Cool.
I want to be doing nothing. I'm doing nothing deliberately.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know that I could do nothing and be that cool with everything.
Conan talked with Stiller about the film Greenberg and also asked him about Gene Wilder's influence.
Oh, yeah. He's definitely, for me, sort of the up on the comedy Mount Rushmore. You know, I think you know, what he did, even like, you know, everything you want to know about sex, but we're afraid to ask.
Mm-hmm.
His sequence with the sheep was classic. And, you know, yeah, Young Frankenstein and... you know, all of his movies, the producers, he's one of those guys who his comic persona is so genuine and his comedy is so subtle and so real. And yeah, for me, he's sort of up there with the greats.
Do you empathize with him, what he was talking about there at the end, the difficulty of finding roles and producers who are willing to take chances on movies?
Sure. I mean, I think it's a tough business to navigate, really, to figure out what you want to do, what studios want to do. You know, even a movie like Greenberg, it was sort of not easy to put together, because I think these days what he was saying is true. You know, these big movies have now become such a business in terms of what the return can be on investments. It's become this math equation for studios, and it's sort of taken out the sense of really, you know, just the creative choice and taking a flyer on a movie because it could be a good movie and now, maybe not make a lot of money.
I don't think Greenberg is going to make what Tropic Thunder made.
I don't know. Let's see what happens.
Well, I could be wrong.
You're probably right. But it's also, you know, the budget is smaller, and it becomes – that's what I meant by the equation, you know, and just – But it's tougher and tougher for the middle of the pack movies, the movies that are not small budget, not big budget, not, you know, comedies, not special effects movies, but sort of that, you know, mid-range drama. I think those are really tough to get off the ground now.
Did you see the script or did you help develop the script?
No, I saw the script, and the only input I had on when I got the script, I think he'd written it for a guy who was about 10 years younger.
Mm-hmm.
And Greenberg's issues were kind of the same, but he was a guy who was in his early 30s. And so when I talked to him about it, and I really would have done anything he wanted me to do because he's just one of those filmmakers that I would go anywhere with. But I said, look, if I was going to play this guy, I feel like I'm a little old. And, you know, what I'm going through as a guy in his 40s, there's some different issues. And we started talking about that. And we just had a discussion about it, about what it meant to get into this, you know, get older, get to this point of your life. And then he went off and did a rewrite, not really based on any specific notes. I think it was just sort of what he took away from it. And he came back with a pretty different movie that I thought was, you know, really amazing because he'd sort of taken it to his own process. And it became more of a love story, I think, somehow. And so that's what it was. And then basically we did the script. I mean, the script did not change from the first day of rehearsal. And that was a really great experience to just do Noah's words and kind of approach it like a play.
You can hear both the Ben Stiller and the Gene Wilder interviews in their entirety at npr.org/culturetopia.
And now from the art of cinema to art on moving vehicles. Like so many visitors to Haiti, Adam Davidson of NPR's Planet Money team found himself captivated by a common sight there. Wildly painted buses carrying passengers through the streets of Port-au-Prince. He decided to get to the bottom of it with this report.
The first thing you notice, the colors. Each bus is unique, its own design, but they do share this. Every inch of every painted bus has the same palette of bright, vivid colors. Then you notice all the painted figures, giant portraits of Jesus, Tupac Shakur, a naked woman in ecstasy, some famous Haitian musician, the wife of the bus driver. Mixed in, all sorts of iconography important to Haitians. American Airlines planes, that's the fastest way from Haiti to Miami. You've also got roosters, goats, snakes, and other voodoo imagery. Everything is rendered in that shiny latex paint that bounces the sunlight. You feel like you can stand on any corner in Port-au-Prince, watch the buses go by, and get direct access to the Haitian subconscious. I cover economics, not art, so I am puzzled by something else. All this painting is really expensive, and Haiti is, of course, a very poor country. How can it make any economic sense for the owners of these buses to spend so much on something that is delightful, but it seems economically frivolous? I asked one driver.
That's the way it was ever since I was born. I always knew the cause for being this color, like, you know, colorful like that.
It's always been done that way? That is not a satisfying answer. I asked Patrick Francois, who drives his own bus, to tell me how much the painting costs.
The artist is about $10,000.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it costs a lot of money.
That's about $1,200 U.S., well, more than double the average annual income in Haiti. Francois says he gets his bus painted at least once a year, sometimes twice. And he says it's not because of tradition, it's not because everyone's always done it. It's simple business.
If you don't paint it like that, people will not get on it.
Is that true? People won't get on buses if you don't paint them? I watched, and Francois is right. The painted buses arrive, fill up with passengers in a few quick minutes, and then take off. A handful of unpainted ones just sit there for a long time, no passengers. Patrick Talusma, a law school dropout who now drives an unpainted bus, has a theory, which he has time to tell me because he has no customers.
It's true. When your car is painted, you get a good reputation.
He says people just have more trust in drivers of painted buses. I asked a customer getting on a painted one if that's right.
If the owner or, you know, a driver has a bus and they don't take care of that bus, nobody is going to want to drive in it.
Ah, this is the key, I realized. Fresh painting sends potential passengers a signal. Whoever owns this bus spends a lot of money taking care of it. at least on the outside, the stuff you can see. And that makes it more likely that he's also taking care of the hidden stuff, the brakes and transmission. There are no bus inspectors in Haiti making sure each one is in good working order. So passengers have to decide in a second which is likely to get them where they're going and which one might just break down on the side of the road. Safest bet? Get on the one with all the fancy painting. Adam Davidson, NPR News.
The band Quasi from Portland, Oregon, has been around the indie rock block a few times. After all, it's 17 years old. The band's new record is its eighth. It's called American Gong. NPR's Jacob Gans talked to the band about how they'd managed to stay in the game and how that game looks when you become its elder statesman.
To understand Quasi today, you need to go back in time. A dozen years ago, the band was on the way up with a great sound. And a story you could tell in 30 seconds. Sam Coombs and Janet Weiss used to be husband and wife. Weiss also played drums in Slater Kinney, a band that Time magazine called the best in America. Coombs played with Elliott Smith. There was every reason to think that Quasi might make it, well, at least medium big.
You know, when we were starting out, it was sort of almost the opposite of a career path. Really, you had to be a little bit nuts to really throw yourself into it.
Sam Coombs and Janet Weiss have lived in Portland since 1989. Jimmy Byron has been a fan of theirs almost that long. Byron books bands at a chain of local venues. He says that Quasi snuck onto the scene as a poppy, harmonizing duo during the heyday of the Pacific Northwest's heavy, lethargic grunge obsession.
Everybody had this kind of dirgy sound, and there was no harmonies, and there was a lot of screaming. And you had this group that was incredibly melodic and really fun.
For a band where both members were seated behind instruments, Quasi made a lot of noise. Coombs on his crazy-sounding vintage Roxacord organ, Weiss hammering off-kilter beats on her drums. By the end of the 90s, Byron says, the band was selling out venues that held 11 or 1,200 fans.
It did seem that there was a point where they were, you know, neck and neck with Modest Mouse and the bands like that that have gone on to huge platinum success while Quasi is kind of maintained this whole time.
And then, somehow, Quasi just outlasted the lifespan of the narrative, the expectations, and the gimmicks. The past is gone, just like you said, but it's not really done if you stir up the hornet's nest. Both of us must get stung. Not to mention that signature Roxacord sound, which Coombs dumped for electric guitar. And then Quasi ditched another feature of the original story. Weiss and Coombs quit playing as a duo.
The intensity of the two-piece, people respond to it, but it doesn't just go away when you walk off stage.
No matter how well you get along, especially given our accumulated history over the years, it's when you get just two people and you lock them in confined spaces for prolonged periods of time, it doesn't matter. Occasionally, it's just loggerheads, you know.
Quasi picked up a bassist, Joanna Bulm, a lifelong Portland native and friend of the band. But even if the lineup and the sound have changed, the philosophy behind the band hasn't. For Quasi, the idea of punk is still essential. Music as a loud, rambunctious form of social criticism that, in the words of writer Grill Marcus, draws lines between young and old. Lately, Weiss and Coombs are finding themselves on an unfamiliar side of that line.
It really feels sometimes like punk never happened. Like, I feel old. I feel like my generation is old now, and it's time for the kids to do their thing, but it is pretty different.
Indie rock has changed in the last 10 years. Where Weiss proudly says she's never played on a song that was used in a commercial or TV show, today that's exactly what indie success has come to mean for many young bands.
Rise up out of your world, one breath. Wait for someone to get.
anyone searching for lessons on how to sustain a fruitful partnership over two decades, Quasi's a good place to look. For NPR News, I'm Jacob Gans.
And now for a musician who's also at an interesting point in her career, Jacob Dylan became famous as the lead singer of the Wallflowers, but in recent years he has hatched into a successful solo artist. His new album, Women in Country, reunites Dylan with producer T-Bone Burnett and adds Nico Case and Kelly Hogan to the mix as backing vocalists. Scott Simon brought in Dylan, Case, and Hogan for an in-studio performance, and he asked Case and Hogan how they came to be part of the new album.
T-Bone Burnett did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, he offhandedly one day goes, you know, really want to get you guys on this Jacob record. And we said, what?
Yeah.
Pants were peed.
Indeed. Guys, pants were
pants
peed.
Pants were peed. Practicing was done.
Yep.
And there we were.
Yeah.
Did T-Bone Burnett run this by you, Mr. Dylan?
Yeah, of course. No, we talked about, while recording, we had a lot of space for background vocals, and we knew as it developed it definitely needed to be women. Men in Country made a far less appealing record title.
For you.
For me. Someone else can probably use that. It's available. But, T-Bone, it was his idea, knowing that they sing as partners and they sing together often. I was, of course, thrilled. I thought he was a little adventurous. I really didn't know they were going to have quite as much time, and they were very busy last year themselves.
Well, could we hear a song?
Sure. Nothing but the whole wide world's a game. Nothing, nothing. Nothing but the whole wide world's a game. Nothing, nothing. Nothing but the whole wide world's a game. I'm here on the blacktop, the sun in my eyes. Women and country on my mind. They're bolting me out over the borderline. There's no more love lost and no more shame. There's no more digging holes or graves. Nothing to lose, rivets and chains. Got nothing but the whole wide world to gain. Nothing but the whole wide world to gain. Nothing, nothing. Got nothing but the whole wide world to gain. Nothing, nothing, and nothing but the whole wide world to gain. Was born in a stable and built like an ox. Down in the pastures and learned how to walk. Mama, she raised me to sing and just let him talk. Said no rich man's worth his weight in dust. Bury him down same as they'll do us. God wants you busy, never giving up. He wants nothing but the whole wide world for us. Nothing but the whole wide world for us. Nothing, nothing. It's nothing but the whole wide world for us. Nothing, nothing. Yeah, nothing but the whole wide world.
You can hear the full interview, more songs, and watch a way cool video of their Tiny Desk concert at nprmusic.org. And that's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Bob Mondello.
And I'm Felix Contreras. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. See you.